The most intelligent and best educated people of those
Baltic states were occupied
savage enemies of the Soviet Union.
Simultaneous arrests and deportations to Siberians were executed by operational groups, forcing their way into the houses. Echelons of overfilled trains packed with people, the majority of whom would never return.
75 years ago this week, an ethnic cleansing campaign began. Three quarters of a century ago this week, tens of thousands of people were uprooted from their homes, their lives, and their families. On June 14, 1941, less than 2 years after the Soviet Union signed a secret pact with Nazi Germany to carve up Europe, and 1 year after the USSR invaded the Baltic states, the mass deportations of Estonians, Latvians, and Lithuanians began. More than 40,000 people, a quarter of them children, were rounded up at gunpoint, stuffed into cattle cars, and forcefully exiled to Siberia. Among the deportees were the three nations' best and brightest, their top political, business, and civic leaders. Fewer than half ever returned home alive. Their anniversary was solemnly marked this week in Tallinn, Riga, and Vilnius, as well as in Europe and in North America. But in Moscow, this dark chapter of World War II has been tossed into the historical memory hole. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is Agnija Grigas, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and author of the books Beyond Crimea, the New Russian Empire, and The Politics of Energy and Memory Between the Baltic States and Russia. Welcome back to the podcast, Agnija. Good to see you again.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. And joining us from Tartu, Estonia, is Maria Malkso, a senior research fellow in international relations at the Johan Schute Institute of Political Studies at Tartu University and author of the book The Politics of Becoming European. Welcome to the podcast, Maria. Glad you could join us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks for coming. And joining us from Tartu also is Velo Pete, a professor of comparative politics at the Johan Schute Institute of Political Studies at Tartu University and co-author of the book Transnational and Retrospective Justice in the Baltic States. Welcome back to the podcast, Velo.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. So, Maria, let's start with you. We got a tradition here. First time on, first question. So, and also, since you've done quite a bit of research into the politics of memory, how important are the deportations and the memory of them and the anniversary of them? How important are these in defining the post-Soviet identities of the Baltic states? And along the same lines, how does Russia's refusal to recognize and acknowledge these events define the Baltic states' relations with Russia?
I think they are obviously immensely important. Otherwise, you wouldn't also have the show, I would guess. But we could say that these deportations for the Baltic states have been a foundational trauma of a sort, a constitutive event for the contemporary political identities as well. Because as many would have it, it was and is still perceived as an attempted decapitation of the nations, because especially these 1941 deportations, which we were just commemorating a few days ago, they were targeting the elites, the political, social, civic, business, military elites. Whereas the 1948-49 deportations were more about basically the social category or the countryside people. So this is something that really is this sort of event, as you would say, Katyn is for the Poles or Holodomor is for the Ukrainians. And it is still very much perceived this way. And of course, it's also, you know, building the immediate link and putting us straight into what Yale historian Timothy Snyder called Molotov-Ribbentrop Europe, which is obviously a very important part of the historical self-definition in all its good and more problematic sides for the Estonians, Latvians and Lithuanians. Now, coming to Russia, then... Well, I'd say that the amount of politicians and the amount of people who would expect anything close to sort of apology or acknowledgement from the official Russia, from the Kremlin, is minimal these days, even though, of course, there is always some sort of rustling and bustle about some more sort of radical politicians asking for compensation for the communist crimes and trying to put them into monetary terms. But this is, I'd say, marginal. And it's also, in a way, I'd say, rather pragmatic if you think of what is the actual Russian discourse these days. One thinks of the recent interview that the Russian foreign minister Sergei Lavrov gave to a Swedish newspaper, Dagens Nyheter, wherein he said that, well, it's funny that the Baltic countries have actually shown no gratitude to Moscow for letting them go in peace in 1991. So this is the backdrop against which I guess we are operating in.
If in some alternative universe, or maybe not alternative universe, but that Russia did come around, and I don't expect it from this regime, but perhaps a future regime, how much mileage would that have in improving the very tense relations between the Baltics and Russia? And how much mileage would it go toward creating goodwill in the Baltics towards Russia? Would an acknowledgement of this go a long way?
I'd say fundamentally so. But of course, you know, as you rightly said, this is not to be expected under the current regime, even though under Medvedev there was certainly some more reconciliatory tone adopted in the overall history of politics of Russia, especially vis-a-vis Poland, of course. But this would be symbolically extremely important and definitely, you know, enable much more enable more constructive relations and just more trust between the four nations.
And it certainly would show a degree of political maturity that we are not seeing from the current regime in the Kremlin. Agnia, your first book also explored the politics of memory between Russia and the Baltics. What are your thoughts along these lines?
When we look at these current tensions over, let's say, deportation or historical memory, we have to understand that these tensions go much deeper. Overall, since the early 90s, Russia and the Russian regime has denied that the Baltic states have been occupied. And this is the basics almost of this historical memory and of the relationship that could potentially improve. And this occupation for Russia, it's part of its broader identity or broader understanding, because really since the end of the Soviet Union, this Soviet victory in World War II has become mythologized. And it's become a part of Russian national identity. So Soviet victory in World War II, the Russian Orthodox Church, and a certain element of anti-Americanism seems like the three pillars right now of Russian national identity. So it's very difficult to let go of.
And from the Baltic side, would you agree with what Maria said, that this is kind of foundational in the identities of the three Baltic states?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The fact that they were occupied, forcibly incorporated into the Soviet Union, it led very much to their legal ideological restoration of the states. I mean, they were always perceived themselves not as newly independent states, but states that have restored their independence following illegal occupation. So it's very difficult for these states to go further in their relations. But we have to also note that there was, in the early 90s, there were signs of progress. In fact, in 1991, Lithuania and the Russian Federation under Yeltsin did sign a document where Russia did admit that it had annexed the Baltic states or annexed Lithuania. It shied away from the word occupation. And really, the very last time that a Russian official, again, openly stated that this annexation had occurred was 1993, Foreign Minister Kozyrev. Since then, there has been a gradual distancing from accepting these facts and acknowledging them. And really, under Putin's regime, this has gone further to absolute denials and statements that the Baltic states voluntarily joined the Soviet Union and so on, and that they had many benefits under the Soviet Union, and no talk whatsoever of any sort of victimization or deportations or so on.
No, and along the lines of the deportation, there's almost an ironic note here. I mean, among the deportees in Estonia was a very young Lennart Meri, who I believe was 12 years old at the time. His father was a major diplomat in Estonia, and he came back to be the first post-Soviet president of Estonia. So the effort at decapitation clearly failed there. Agne, you wanted to jump in here?
Yes, because also when we started out, we talked about the one day and the 40,000 deported. But over the years, the early years of Soviet occupation, there were 200,000 people deported from the Baltic states. And this, almost every single family in the Baltic states was affected, either through direct deportations or executions, or people fled. And this has a tremendous impact on the national self-identity. It has an impact on every single family almost in the Baltic states. They have memories and relatives of people being deported, executed, or fleeing the country.
Yeah, no, I recall early 2000, if I'm not mistaken. I was when the Estonians first opened the KGB archives. I was looking at a lot of the files. You had to get permission of the subject of the file to do it, but that wasn't very hard to get, and it was really overwhelming going through all those files and looking at the things people were deported or even executed for. Velo, you've written about transitional and retrospective justice in the Baltics. How have the Baltic states sought justice for the crimes of the past, and how successful has this effort been?
Well, they certainly have been trying, despite the fact that, of course, we had, by 1990, of course, almost 50 years had passed since these atrocities had been committed. But all three countries did begin in the early 90s with efforts to investigate a lot of these deportations, these killings, in all of the different phases, meaning that in the 1940-41 period, in the 48-49 period, have tried to not only gather the facts and not only from victims, but of course also other evidence relating to these events, but also to try to place them into some kind of international law context, because you cannot seek justice if you don't literally, of course, have some kind of criminal code that you can use to then proceed and move forward into a court of law and actually seek conviction and punishment. So this was another aspect in which efforts were made to change the criminal codes, to amend the criminal codes, and essentially it boiled down to a number of different categories, if you will: war crimes, crimes against humanity, and then also genocide. And so each of the countries has been trying to figure out which of the events, which of the actual killings could, if you will, qualify or would go under one or the other. And each of those actually have their own strengths and weaknesses and problems, because if you try to do certain events as genocide, then of course these are very extensive and very even well worked out things in international law that you cannot easily simply do after the fact, as it were. And we run into all of those issues whereby the people who actually committed these crimes were not necessarily liable for them at the time. And so you get questions of retroactive justice as well, and whether that's even permitted under international law. So in total, however, the all three Baltic states have tried to they've investigated several dozen individuals in relation to all of the different deportations and killings during the 1940s, and have ultimately convicted somewhere around 35-40 people, Lithuania being the most active in this regard, and mostly in the post-war period. But if we're talking about 1941, then yes, about a half dozen people have actually been arrested and put on trial, although there have all been, as have been the Holocaust perpetrators, well into their 70s, 80s, 90s, and many have indeed passed away in the process of this justice.
Has there been any talk of maybe having something like a truth commission like South Africa had, where you were not talking about prosecutions, but we're just talking about kind of reconciliation? Has there been any efforts in that direction?
I think that the temporal distance just makes that too difficult, because, again, there are few perpetrators still left. especially now if we're talking about 75 years. And also many of them had left for Russia, or maybe even already, you know, after their job was done in the 40s, and they would have been reassigned somewhere else in the Soviet Union. So those who were to be arrested or detained in any way were done so, but others indeed in the process of their investigation would have fled to Russia. And I just wanted to add one more point about the history, because I think everything that Maria said about being a foundational moment is essential. It all derived in advance of that from the occupation itself in 1940. But let's not forget actually the next event, which was indeed the Nazi invasion, barely a few weeks afterwards, and how this these set of deportations in June 1941 really set the stage, for lack of a more sophisticated phrase, for how indeed the Baltics would receive the Nazi invasion of July 1941. And this is not, of course, to paper over the difficulties of that invasion or any of the Nazi occupation period, but it is just very so constitutively important to look at these events in some kind of relation to each other. And so that's why I think it's worth mentioning that.
Agnė, you wanted to jump in here, and I want to stick with that point as well in a bit, but please, Agnė.
Going back a little to your point, whether any sort of historical commission could be possible now, any sort of reconciliation based on the facts. And this is increasingly problematic because, in fact, the Russian Federation has taken active steps now, not just to deny Soviet occupation, but to almost rewrite and revise history. So in 2009, there was the President's Commission to Prevent Falsification of History established. And really the main purpose of this Russian commission is to deny Stalinist repressions, to deny Soviet occupation, and to either deny or try to rehabilitate the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. So in this current, at least, atmosphere and the current policies from Russia, it becomes very difficult to find any sort of historical accord.
Maria.
Just quickly to add, this commission actually by now has been disbanded. But of course, Russia has tried to protect its version of the events, which, you know, as we've surely established, indeed diverge very significantly from the Baltic versions of the events, of the conduct and consequences of World War II. But it has tried to really enshrine its version of the events in law and protect it by means of law. So basically, you know, in the midst of the unfolding of the Ukraine crisis, we saw how Russia amended its criminal code and added this new memory law within its criminal codes, whereby not just the rehabilitation of Nazism, which I'm afraid already Vella's statement is you know, about establishing the nexus between the events of June and July in the Baltic states of 1941 might qualify for it, but also the dissemination of false information about what the Soviet army did in the Second World War.
Actually, it's even gone farther than that. I mean, you've had bills introduced into the State Duma declaring the very independence of the Baltic states to be illegal. These have never passed, but things like this don't happen in Russia for an accident. A bill doesn't get introduced into the Duma by accident. It gets introduced it into the Duma to send a message. You've had attempts to prosecute Lithuanian so-called draft dodgers who evaded the Soviet draft in the dying days of the Soviet Union, and Moscow had the gall to ask Vilnius to help extradite these people to Russia, so it's gone even further. But Velo, I wanted to pick up a bit on the point you make on the nexus between the Soviet occupation and the Nazi occupation, and what this gets into, kind of like Timothy Snyder's notion of Europe between Hitler and Stalin, or Molotov-Ribbentrop Europe, if you will, and the difficulties that entails. I mean, where were you going with that? Were you going with that it made the three Baltics more receptive to the Nazi invasion at that time, or where were you going with that?
Well, I certainly think that we would have to pick up on the notion that Maria raised, that this was a foundational not only event but trauma. And so you had this 24-hour period, if you will, in a beautiful summer period of 1941 taking place, these deportations. And I don't, you know, and we all know that most people weren't anticipating the Nazi invasion or the immediate sort of arrival of the Nazi forces. And so in that sense, you know, these things coming one upon each other was very much, and I think part of my point was really to raise precisely this fact that the Baltic states are part of this Molotov-Ribbentrop Europe. And if we talk about that, then it's not just August 39 and the pact itself, but it's all of this back and forth series of events that then took place. And just to show how complicated it was by not only end of the war, but in the years after the war, and really dragging it out at least until the 50s, if not until, of course, 1991 itself, when of course the Baltic states would say, well, then World War II finally ended for the Baltic states. So,
no, I can't help but recall in the context of this conversation, the conversation I had back, it must have been 1999 or 2000 with a Latvian Holocaust survivor. I was in Riga to look into a story about the Latvian Legionnaires when that controversy was bubbling up, as it does kind of almost every year now. But this was the early days of that. And I went to Riga to look into that story. And as part of the story, I interviewed a Latvian Holocaust survivor and to get his opinions on this. And I'll never forget it. He looked at me and he said, "Do you think I'm a Stalinist?" And I said, "No, sir, I don't really have any reason to believe you are." He's like, "Well, you know, I fought in Stalin's army. I fought in the Red Army." And he said, "Because for me, there was nothing more evil than the Nazis. So I understood Stalin was evil, but I fought in his army because the Nazis were more evil." But what you have to understand is for these Latvians that were in this legion, there were these legionnaires, there was nothing more evil than the Red Army. So they fought with what they saw at the time, and we didn't have the benefit of historical perspective that we have now. At that time, looked like the lesser evil. And so I don't have any problem with this. Maria, go ahead.
Just following up on that and following up on what Bella just elaborated on, you know, the Baltic states between Hitler and Stalin, and also what was... This was very much indeed the case in the Second World War in terms of how the historical events unfolded. But it was also very much the case in terms of the memory wars of post 1991 and in the more immediate years. Basically, the Baltic states discovering that again they fell in between the hegemonic narratives, the hegemonic narrative of Europe in terms of what was the ultimate evil, right, and whether or not perhaps these evil regimes and their atrocities could be comparable to any degree. And then the Russian hegemonic narrative of the Second World War, which, of course, in very important points actually coincided with the European hegemonic narrative. So that was the challenge in terms of, in a way, continuing this in-betweenness and continuing this battle for the Baltic states also to get the necessary message through what was the actual predicament of the Baltic states in the context of the Second World War.
Velo, go ahead.
But I just wanted to add that it's a very tough struggle for the Baltic states, of course, to challenge these hegemonic narratives, and they have tried to a considerable extent, of course, in European institutions, and if not vis-a-vis Russia, of course, as we've seen, it's been very difficult, but certainly within Europe. But there are limits to that, of course, and there's a very dominant place for the European understanding of World War II, and it's difficult to raise perhaps the Eastern European or the Molotov-Ribbentrop Europe version of things without being accused of relativization or equalization of Stalinism and Nazism.
You had a cluster of countries who had two enemies and no place to turn. And another thing it did was it gives Russia the opportunity to say, well, they were all just Nazi collaborators, and dismiss it at that. Agnia, you wanted to jump in?
Yes, on several points. Well, it is true. Russia has tried to use this narrative, especially in the recent years, this narrative of fascism and the Nazi collaboration. I mean, currently it's quite known that you know, this fascist narrative is almost a favorite narrative out of the Kremlin. Whoever they perceive as their enemies or opponents, they're immediately branded as fascists and so on, which is quite ironic for the fact that today Kremlin's closest friends tend to be the far-right parties of Europe. And there's another aspect also between these hegemonic narratives. There's also the fact that in 1990-91, when the Baltic states finally had an opportunity to talk about their history, this was also a watershed moment, but we have to realize this was 50 years after the facts, in a way. And the societies hadn't talked about these events and hadn't examined them, and they had to, you know, make up for that time themselves, and as societies also heal and overcome some of the traumatic experiences they had experienced. And when it comes to the Legionnaires, I just quickly want to note also that few of them were really volunteers. Many of them were forcibly drafted into the legions.
Another thing I wanted to touch on was the legacy of the deportations. We talked a bit about decapitation earlier on. I made the point that using the example of Leonard Mary, well, that kind of failed. Estonia got one of its greatest leaders ever, who was one of the deportees as a child. But another thing that changed was the demographics, of course. I mean, this is probably the biggest legacy that I could see of the deportations, the dramatic demographic change of the country, creating what essentially now is something Russia tries to use as a fifth column, whether or not it can do so successfully in Estonia and Latvia, less so in Lithuania because the Russian population is so small. Velo, did you want to jump in?
I just wanted to elaborate on the fact that these demographic changes were multifaceted or multiple, in the sense that it was, of course, the removal of Estonians and Latvians and Lithuanians from their homelands. Then there was also, of course, the Holocaust itself and the destruction of the Jewish populations. Then there were shifts in borders that caused Russian populations to be shifted to the Russian Federation. A lot of the small minorities that we know, the Swedes in Estonia, or of course the shifts of the Polish population between Poland and Lithuania. And then you've got the post-war deportations that we've hinted at here and there. And then you have, of course, people that fall into my category, namely, of course, the Balts who fled in 1944 and settled in different Western countries and then had offspring there. And so I don't know that we can make any definitive statements about decapitation in terms of the loss of intellectual capacity and where we would be today with theater or arts or political science.
I don't think any
science.
Of the three Baltics have a problem with intellectual capacity today, I'll
well,
say that.
That's perhaps, but just that nevertheless, I think, yes, we have to recognize all of those population losses and the diversity of them as they end up happening.
And the creation of this potential fifth column. Agnia and Maria, you both want to jump in. Who wants to go first?
Agnia, you first.
Go first.
Well,
Agnia.
I just have to follow then on the Russian compatriots, the subject of my newest book. So certainly after the Baltic states lost their native population, there was an influx of ethnic Russians and Russian speakers and other nationalities into the three Baltic states. They came often in as laborers to support industrialization. They came as part of the Soviet army, as military officers, and so on. And of course, exactly the demographics of the countries changed with now significant Russian-speaking minorities, especially in Estonia and Latvia, and a little bit less so in Lithuania. And certainly today, this is a big issue for the three Baltic states, specifically because especially in the Putin years, the Kremlin has pursued a policy that they will protect Russian speakers, whom they call compatriots, in foreign territories and, you know, protect them in whatever ways they can. We've seen some of that protection already in Crimea and eastern Ukraine and in Georgia, South Ossetia, Abkhazia. It's after one tragedy, now there's an ongoing risk or tension in societies. And again, Russia also works hard to try to exploit ethnic tensions and to try to fuel ethnic tensions in the Baltic states.
So the legacy of this continues to today. Maria, you wanted to jump in as well?
I just wanted to add a historical footnote that regardless of the encouraging example of Leonard Meri and his return from Siberia and a very successful sort of becoming a symbol figure of the Estonia's rise from the ashes, right? Actually, these 1941 deportations were particularly deadly, and especially for the male deportees. Out of the, say, 5,000 in Estonia's case, the estimation is about 100 returned actually alive. And when I talked about the decapitation, I was also really sort of mentally including what happened to the political military elite immediately after the Soviets actually came in a year earlier, June 1940, basically, when roughly out of 48 former Estonian government members who were arrested, only three survived. So this gives you also some sort of sense of what was really going on there.
Before we move on to the second half, there's one other thing I wanted to touch on, and this is I'm recalling the 1989 Baltic Way, you know, the human chain across the border of the three Baltic states, what was then the Russian Republic of the USSR. I knew a lot of Russians that participated in that. I mean, and it just shows me how much things have deteriorated since that time. I lived in St. Petersburg, and I had a lot of friends who were part of that. And I got the impression that a lot of Russians were actually part of that, and that you would never see anything like that today. And how has this evolved over time? I mean, it's certainly gotten worse. But from your perspective, how and why has this happened?
Well, at the start, Yeltsin did support the independence on the Baltic states. Pragmatic in some parts on his part, because it meant the weakening of the Soviet regime and therefore the strengthening of his own, let's say, government and his own personal leadership over the Russian Federation. And as I noted earlier, these accords on historical memory, which were showing, you know, positive signs in the early 90s, slowly started to deteriorate. I think part of it could have been related to the fact that, for example, maybe Lithuania was actively stated that they will seek compensation for occupation. Maybe there was, therefore, this element of wanting to distance themselves from that truth so they don't face the consequences. But really, by the time Putin comes to power, he takes, as I again noted, counteractive measures, really measures of deniability of historical events.
Counteractive measures and active measures, I might
and
add.
And active measures.
Preventive measures.
I mean, I think that also not only the Russian Federation, but first and foremost, many of the Russian speakers, in particularly Estonia and Latvia, were, for obvious reasons, disappointed over the Baltic's citizenship policies. And those who had participated in the Baltic chain or in many of the other popular front events and what have you, suddenly found themselves in late 91, 92 without citizenship or with Soviet citizenship. And of course, we could debate the legal aspects of why Estonia and Latvia in particular adopted those policies and why they're in many ways very grounded and founded on international law and the way in which the Baltic states were occupied by the Soviet Union. But from an individual standpoint, of course, these people felt in many cases, you know, betrayed, and there was probably, of course, no way of linking participation in the Baltic chain with getting citizenship later on. You couldn't just show a photograph of yourself standing in the chain and then be made eligible for citizenship nevertheless. So you had these tough choices that were made, and I think they laid the groundwork, of course, for a lot of disillusionment, for a lot of dissatisfaction. Of course, it never erupted into a very serious tension or conflict, perhaps not until April of 2007,
right,
with the Bronze Soldier events. But of course, those came in a still additional separate context. But if we're talking about the early 1990s, then this was a low point, of course, in Baltic-Russian minority relations. And we've had to climb out a little bit from that with certain integration programs, bring the societies back together, because the key element of the arrival of so many Soviet citizens and Russians to the Baltic states during the Soviet period is that they did arrive, but they never necessarily integrated and assimilated into the populations. So these sociological problems that were there in the early 90s remained, that so many of these people didn't have very much Estonian or Latvian linguistic ability, and so they were also marginalized. And so all of this marginalization became compounded upon itself in the 1990s, and we've had to deal with it ever since.
Who wants to give the last word? Go ahead, Maria.
I just very quickly, this issue still has also extreme, of course, symbolic and instrumental political value. As we just recently saw, there was this media was with pleasure digging on these parliamentarians in Estonia who did not support this particular commemoration declaration that the parliament issued, and most of them were with Russian names and of Russian heritage in Estonia, and they gave various sorts of reasons, but I guess, you know, most of the reasons eventually boiled down to what just Vello brought out, the citizenship rights or the lack thereof.
Agnija, last word here before we move on to the second part.
If we're looking at what ifs, or, you know, some of the maybe mistakes that the Baltic states made, we also really have to question whether things would have been different, because Lithuania did grant automatic citizenship to all inhabitants of Lithuania, all Russians, all Russian speakers, but it's not that they've received a green pass or better relations either with Russia, nor that Russia didn't stop trying to incite ethnic tensions and conflict in Lithuania itself.
They've even tried to incite ethnic tension between Lithuanians and Poles, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
So on that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and widen the aperture to look at the broader struggle for history as Putin's Russia sanctifies the memory of World War II and makes it a pillar of the regime's legitimizing myth. I would like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is Agnija Grigas, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and author of the books Beyond Crimea, The New Russian Empire, and The Politics of Energy and Memory Between the Baltic States and Russia. And joining us from Tartu, Estonia is Maria Malkso, a senior research fellow in international relations at the Johann Schutte Institute of Political Studies at the University of Tartu, and author of the book The Politics of Becoming European. And joining us also from Tartu is Vello Pete, a professor of comparative politics at the Johann Schutte Institute of Political Studies at Tartu University, and co-author of the book Transitional and Retrospective Justice in the Baltic States. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Мы не приемлем, как сами утверждения об оккупации прибалтийских государств.
We accept neither the claims about Soviet Union's occupation of the Baltic countries as such, nor, accordingly, any related absurd, absolutely unfounded claims directed at Russia without any legal or historic basis whatsoever, including those of material nature.
That, of course, was Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova disavowing any culpability for the Soviet occupation of the Baltic states. Moscow, of course, is eager to take credit for other aspects of World War II. There were war planes streaking over the Kremlin. There were tanks rolling down Moscow's streets. There were ICBMs rolling across Red Square. And there was a lot of praise for the brilliance of the Soviet leadership and heroism of the Red Army between 1941 and 1945. But what was conspicuously absent when Russia marked Victory Day last month was any discussion of what happened between 1939 and 1941. No commemorations of the brutal occupation of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, no ceremonies marking the partition and destruction of Poland, and of course no discussion of the secret protocols of the infamous Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and the fact that the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany were actually allies when the war began. These things aren't recognized because under Vladimir Putin, the memory of World War II has been turned into something of a religion, an ideology and a legitimizing myth that glorifies and sanctifies the Russian state. The events of 39 to 41 just don't fit the narrative. They're heresy. The sanctification of World War II is largely a domestic tool for the Putin regime, but the effects are felt among Russia's neighbors as well. How do you see, we've covered a lot of this in the first half, but there's plenty of room here, plenty of material to deal with here. How do you see the effects of this sanctification in the Baltic states? I mean, there's some obvious examples. The Bronze Horseman controversy in 2007 immediately comes to mind. The Latvian Legionnaires, which comes up every year. But how do you see this playing itself out in the Baltics? How do you feel Russia's kind of sanctification of history playing out there?
We are usually used to having this continuity issue or continuity thesis, if not a continuity problem, in the Baltic states. But we actually tend to forget that in identity terms, Russia has very much had a very serious continuity problem after the collapse of the Soviet regime. And it has been in the search of a positive sense of identification. As you very rightly noticed, there isn't much to positively identify with and about in the Russian history of the 20th century. And thus, this emphasis on the victory. particularly the victory and the immense human sacrifices that were made in the Second World War. And this obviously doesn't go very well together with simultaneously remembering all the things that the Soviet Union itself was involved in at the time and at the very time. And thus this sort of sorting out this perpetrator-victim balance for Russia itself hasn't been very successful so far, because obviously, you know, their own knee-jerk reaction would be that actually we were the biggest victims, both of the Stalinist regime as well as in terms of suffering the human losses in the Second World War. Obviously, it has implications, and it has implications in all these aspects that you already mentioned, and this is very much due to the one is inevitably reminded of American diplomat George Kennan's famous words that the eye of the Kremlin only manages to see either vassals or enemies. So those at its borders have to decide which ones they want to be. And in terms of, you know, what happened post-1991, obviously the Baltics didn't want to be anymore the vassals, and many of these tensions and these mnemonic conflicts have been also really fueled by this sad realization on the side of Russia that, well, you know, too bad, they don't want to do that anymore, but thus they have to be enemies, and thus we have to very powerfully fight against what they are trying to do in terms of establishing their own independent idea of how the history, historical events took place, as was the case with the Bronze Soldier. Yeah. Very vividly.
Velo, anything to add?
Yeah, I would just say that now we really do have about 20 plus years of this kind of interaction with Russia about the past events and interpretation of them and admitting to whatever might have happened. And in a way, it's gotten pretty stale. You know, we hear the same kinds of accusations or the same kinds of debates every year. Naturally, the things are a bit flared up on both sides. You've mentioned the Latvian Legionnaires. You've mentioned here in Estonia, there are, of course, groups of Wehrmacht veterans who gather every year. And that serves for at least a good press release from the foreign ministry in Moscow, again, denouncing the rising head of fascism or what have you. But more or less, or by and large, the Baltics have started to take this stuff in stride and just understood that this is part of the frozen conflict, if you will, that we have over memory, and we're going to have to live with it until there's some kind of change. And I think that where we've had the more dangerous flare-ups are involved indeed the Bronze Soldier, because there I think that there was going a bit too far on the Estonian side, insisting on the removal of this monument, and that really allowed the youth in Tallinn to just sort of spew out a lot of their frustration over this and perhaps other things in society. So hopefully we can avoid those kinds of incidents more in the future. But the rest is kind of, yeah, we know the dates. We know things are going to happen. We just take them quietly.
On one hand, I mean, isn't it reasonable that Estonians and others want to remove some of these Soviet war monuments? At the same time, Russia is getting very aggressive at protecting these monuments, not just in the Baltics, in throughout Europe.
I just think that we, in the particular case of the Bronze Soldier, of course, we'd lived with it for already 20 plus years, and so things were relatively stable around it, and it was very much of a political thing that just went haywire.
Agni?
Well, I have to comment on the Bronze Soldier event, because, well, first of all, we have to note that it wasn't a removal of this monument. It was a relocation of this monument to a military cemetery, which was a more appropriate place for the monument. And second, we have to acknowledge to what extent Russia played a hand in inciting those riots. This was really the first case, I think, where Russia practiced its kind of a hybrid warfare.
Political technology, yes.
Yes, in the Baltic states, how it combined information warfare, were spreading lies in Russian language media that the monument was destroyed and the graves of the soldiers were decimated and so on, absolute lies, to try to incite the population. There were also Russian activists illegally crossing the Estonian border to come into the country and incite those riots. So again, I think this was a little bit more than just something over historical discord. It was a manufactured conflict. Mm-hmm. Another element I wanted to touch on where I think Russia may have to also reassess their memory of World War II and their assumptions of total victory there is, well, how this is perceived in Ukraine and Belarus. Because the Russian Federation has, in a way, tried to also own this victory. And there were 20 to 30 million losses, but those were of Soviet citizens. And many of them were Ukrainians and Belarusians who today feel that, you know, they're, again, they're facing a falsification of history. Their participation is not acknowledged, and this is perceived somehow as a Russian victory. And on top of this, now that Ukrainians are being smeared as fascists and so on, where they fought fascism probably most bravely.
Yeah, the Ukrainians and the Belarusians, for sure. No, I'm really, really glad you brought that up, because this is something that's been bothering me, the conflation of Soviet losses in the Second World War with Russian losses in the Second World War. I read in the very early days of the Ukraine conflict, I read a really interesting piece by a German political scientist. I cannot recall his name, but it was making this argument about why Germany always gives Russia the benefit of the doubt in these conflicts. And he's like, it's because we have this war guilt towards Russia, and we should have war guilt, but we should also have it towards the Ukrainians, because proportionally, the Ukrainians lost a lot more than the Russians. Numerically, no, but proportionally, certainly so, and the Belarusians even more so. So I'm very, very glad that you brought that up. Before we wrap it up, there's one thing I kind of wanted. It came to me as during this discussion is a lot of this struggle for history between the Baltics and Russia isn't just about the Baltics and Russia. It's about Europe. Really. And Russia, the way Russia is dealing with the Baltics is almost a litmus test and a metaphor for its attitude towards Europe, until this history of Molotov-Ribbentrop Europe is cleared up and there's a narrative we can all agree on. European history isn't really complete, is it? I mean, it's really European history doesn't really make sense until we work these issues out, or until historians work these issues out, or historians have worked them out. But until there's some kind of narrative that's agreed upon, are we ever going to get to that point?
Well, I'd say that we should aim at trying to give floor to these competing accounts. I don't think we can agree on a single narrative, nor I don't think that it's actually even possible or reasonable or viable. I mean, there are certain facts that of course would be good to have some more agreement about. But in terms of how communities and people perceive the significance and the relative either heroism or victimhood within a historical event, this will always remain different. And it's very difficult to build this sort of unified narrative around that. And I think it would even be, in a way, totalizing, I don't see this will happen. We would need to have Arseniy Roginsky as the Russian president, and then it might, you know, we might have some sort of convergence of views there, but it's unlikely to happen anytime soon, right?
Vella?
Well, I would like to say that I think that finding a consensus around historical issues, of course, is very much in the framework of a triangle. I mean, we have Eastern Europe with this Molotov-Ribbentrop Europe, we have Western Europe, and then we have Russia that is trying to influence both sides. And as I already hinted, the relationship between Molotov-Ribbentrop Europe and Western Europe is already complicated enough. But then you sort of have Russia instrumentalizing those complicated relations and trying to poke its finger into different controversial aspects of that coming to terms between Western and Eastern Europe. So, I mean, I've seen some progress within the European Union. Of course, the European Union is trying to provide money and other organizational support, if you will, for how people remember and understand different historical events. But as long as we have this sort of noise coming from the East in the midst of this slow-moving effort within Europe, then it's going to be complicated.
I'm glad that Maria raised the issue of giving voice, because I think that's actually really important. And certainly the three Baltic states have contributed to this enormously over the past quarter century. But another thing, I mean, this is one of the unintended consequences of the Ukraine conflict, I think. is that as a result of the way the Ukraine conflict played out, the way the Russia tried to use the World War II narrative, and the way others responded, specifically with this, including this German political scientist who pointed out a fact that everybody had always had been conveniently ignoring or forgetting about for a long time, we are getting counter narratives. We're learning about what happened in World War II in Ukraine specifically, and how that was distinct in a lot of ways from the grand Russian narrative. So I think we are beginning to see this, and maybe this giving, well, maybe we won't have a common agreed upon narrative, but by giving voice to these other narratives, we're moving forward. Agnia, go ahead.
Let's not forget also the Eurovision song contest this year and the winner from Crimea who won specifically with a song of Stalin's deportation of the Crimean Tartars. Again, giving voice and shedding light on this element of history, very similar to what we talked about today. But while we may not think that a reconciliation on history will happen soon, actually, I think it's a must. I think until a country and a society has reflected and come to terms with their history, they cannot move forward. I would not say that Russia will never do this. I mean, let's look at Germany today. Germany agrees on World War II events with the rest of European powers. There's no discord there. Even Vladimir Putin admitted in 2010 to the Katyn massacre in Poland. So I think we can and we should expect some sort of reconciliation, at least on the facts of history in the future.
I'm glad you mentioned Jamala, because she did pay a visit to Vilnius on the 14th to show solidarity and met with the Lithuanian president. And I thought that was a pretty powerful moment. You mentioned Katyn, too. And I was very surprised by that. And I said, well, wow, maybe this is the beginning of something. It was a bit premature optimism on my part and on the part of others. But there was movement there. But with the Baltics, for Russia, it's so much more visceral. I'm not sure we're going to see, certainly under this regime, nothing. But
no.
But until Russia comes to terms with this, because let's face it, the problem here is Russia. I mean, everybody else is facing their history, to varying degree, with varying degrees of difficulty, but facing it. But you have outright denial and refusal. You heard the words of Maria Zakharova at the start of this. You're just ignoring basic facts that are in the historical record and that everybody agrees on. All right, on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. has been Agnia Grigas, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and author of the books Beyond Crimea, The New Russian Empire, and The Politics of Energy and Memory Between the Baltic States and Russia. And joining us from Tartu, Estonia, has been Maria Malkso, a senior research fellow in international relations at the Johann Schutte Institute of Political Studies at the University of Tartu, and author of the book The Politics of Becoming European. Also joining us from Tartu has been Velo Pete, a professor of comparative politics at the Johann Schutte Institute of Political Studies at Tartu University, and co-author of the book Transitional and Retrospective Justice in the Baltic States. Thank you all for an enlightening and interesting discussion.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
And also like to thank our producers, Pavel Balak and Andreas Kuchina, who are filling in for the vacationing Tanya Koncheva, and to my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. You can also follow Pavel on the Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.